one big trip.
So, and then the others of you too.
I'm thinking.
Go on. So we'll go to that. Now, in the introduction, I want to say this. And we often forget it. And I'll go back into the lab when I was in medical school and seminary medicine. We, of course, use some of these narcotics. And I'll never forget it, sir, when we gave morphine, for example, to dogs in the laboratory. And they sort of black out, you know, with it. It depresses them. They might vomit a bit. We use it often as a pre-anesthetic drug, as they do on you or some of the morphine derivatives. And then we gave some to a cat, you know. And boy, that cat climbed the roof and didn't about walk the ceiling, you know. I mean, you just don't use morphine on a cat unless you want it to climb the ceiling, you know. Showing this great variability there between species. But the thing I want to point out to you is you also have this variability in man. And we often forget that, you know. We look at all your people, and you look at me, you know, and you never see anything quite like this, you know. Well, that's a good thing, probably. But I mean, there's some people that probably have to stoop to come through this door, and you could cut it in half, and some people could still get through it, okay? I mean, there's a lot of variability. And I want you to keep that in mind as we go through this tonight. There's variability in your size of the organs, but there's variability in your chemistry and how you react to these things. And I want you to keep that in mind. Now, to go right into the narcotics. Now, the problem drugs are roughly divided into the narcotics and then into the dangerous drugs. Don't ask me why they break it down this way, but that's how we're going to do it tonight, and that's how a lot of other people do it. Now, narcotics are substances that induce sleep, dull the senses, and relieve pain. Sounds like some Sunday morning sermon. But some lecture, yes. But this, usually, you know, in the pharmacology, we sort of divide drugs into classes, but this is not one class of drugs, but many that have been grouped together, really, for purposes, for legal purposes, you see, for legal control. And under federal control, then, under the federal law for narcotics are the opiates and cocaine. And under most states, we also add marijuana, which is also classified as a narcotic. Now, let's first talk about the opiates briefly. When I talk about opiates, I'm referring to opium, morphine, and their derivatives and compounds and the synthetic equivalents. And these are all under you have to have a license to use these. You see, when I, like several years ago, you renew your license every year for these. I'm sure Dr. Gamrath and probably some of the rest of you, Campone. I mean, you have these licenses, you got to renew them every year, and then you got to do a survey, and there's very strict control on these things. Very strict control. You got to keep them locked up and keep a good inventory of them. Now, they have great medical value, these opiates. They differ in use, in effects, and addiction potential. Most common of these are morphine. Probably many of you have had morphine. It makes for a nice sleep. It really does. When I was in Africa, I had some. In Sicily, when we were fighting a war. It's great for relief of pain. Codeine is most often used in cough syrups. Most of the concern in this area is not with morphine and cocaine, but with heroin, which is a morphine derivative. And it's the chief drug addiction in the United States. It's a hard drug. And it's against the law to have it in your possession or use it. I mean, you're not licensed to use heroin. Now, the effect of heroin depends on the person, his mood, and also his expectation as to what this is going to do to him. Essentially, it's a depressive. It relieves anxiety and tension. It diminishes the primary drives for, like, sex and hunger. It causes drowsiness, it causes an inability to concentrate. It impairs mental and physical performance. And repeated administration leads to tolerance. That is, I mean, you can take a little more each time, sort of. And also physical dependence. By that I mean addiction or physical dependence. It depends on who you talk to, how they define that term. But this addiction is set in motion, probably the first time you take it. All addicts, of course, are registered. In a way, those that they know about are all registered with the Bureau of Narcotics. There are about 58,000 registered today. And then there's probably a lot more that has been estimated up as high as 200,000. But this may be a little high. Most of them are males between 21 and 30, and most of them are in the disadvantaged minority groups. Some may wish to argue these points. Now, the difficulty with it too, it leads to personal neglect and malnutrition. And of course, if you take an overdose, who's that football player, the big Negro football player? Yeah, Dad Lipscomb, you know. I mean, he died from an overdose of a hard drug. He went into respiratory failure, coma and death. And the other bad thing about this, of course, is if you don't get it, you know, you have withdrawal symptoms, which are manifested, well, you see that it peaks out at about 1 or 2 days, I think. It varies with the individual. So you show up with muscle aches, cramps, and nausea. Now, heroin is not, as I indicated earlier, is not available for medical use. It's illegal, and it's a criminal offense to have it. Cocaine is a powerful stimulant. It does not create tolerance or physical dependence. It comes from the leaf of the coca plant. Now, the subject of marijuana. And this is really the hottest issue on the campuses today. There's a great polemic on this. I mean, there's a lot of argument. There are people who say, it's now a felony in most places, you know. I mean, and a felony, that's a serious, that's a criminal offense, of course. And it called for a high fine and for up to, I suppose, 10 years imprisonment to have it in your possession or dealing it and so forth. And there are people, and I've heard them on campuses, say it should be legalized because this is no worse than alcohol. And I'm going to say more about that next week. But boy, we just need something more that's as bad as alcohol, you know? we'd probably go under. Just like Menninger said, if alcoholism were recognized as a disease like polio or something, we'd declare a national emergency. And that's the truth, as far as I'm concerned, and many others. Now, marijuana, and there are many people who feel, and a lot of students use this, and they use it sort of like the old beer parties, you know? I mean, all the graduate students get together, things are rough, they get together, and they have a sort of a smoking session. And they get a little high on it. And they feel that have double martinis for lunch, and you have five or six in the evening, and all we do is gather once a week and get a little high on this stuff. And we might get 10 years, and you don't get anything except a bad head the next day. Now, marijuana, and I'll get into how it acts here in a minute, you can probably detect some prejudice on my part as I get into this. It's hard to be objective on some of this. It comes from the flowering tops, and as you might suppose, the female hemp plant. It's cannabis. It grows wild in temperate and semi-tropical climates. It's everywhere. I mean, you can grow it almost anywhere. Most of ours comes from Mexico. They grow a good deal of it there.
Did you hear the latest rumor is that the United States is supporting burning of marijuana fields in Mexico, and the lids have gone up. at least it'd be up.
Have they really?
Yeah.
How much is a lid now?
Well, I heard someone drew them down to $11, was 50, you got it down there to 11.50.
Yeah, the price on a good cigarette, it is a good deal. I don't know, you can in Chicago you can get one for about 50 or 75 cents in some places. Maybe it's up now. But in Vientiane, in Laos, you can get a couple of them for less than 2 cents. That's why a lot of them are gathering in Vientiane, sort of the last stopping place for a lot of people. Now, there's no established medical use for marijuana, unless somebody knows of some that I don't know about. The effects are very complicated. It's both a stimulant and a depressant. It depends on the personality of the user. It causes exaltation, hilarity, disconnected ideas, or reveries, quietude, or panic. I know one panic case, in Seattle, well, maybe that's as good a place as any to bring this up. A good friend of mine, he was at Harvard and then he came to the University of Washington, finished his PhD in neurophysiology. His name is Fred Harris. He's a good jazz man, plays in jazz orchestra in Seattle, and he's been playing there ever since he got there. But he's a real bug on dope addiction, and he's really shook up about it because so many of his musician friends are either on the needle or they're beating the weed some way, you know. And some of them are hitting LSD. And he's seeing these fellows go down the tubes, you see. And it's really, really sad. And he's really up in arms about it, you know. I mean, like his, well, I'll tell about the LSD one. But and they have quite a few pot parties, you see, these fellows. And one of the fellows, they've been really pressing. Yeah. Hey, why don't you get with it, you know? You see, you don't have the excuse with beating the weed, you know, that you have in alcohol. You can say you're on the wagon. But how do you say that when you're beating the weed, you know? You're not on, I don't know how you say it, you know? Well, nobody else has figured out how it is. You know, I'm on the wagon. I haven't figured out the expression for that. So they're under great pressure then to smoke it. So this kid, he did, but he's a rather stable fellow. But he smoked it, and he was really, he almost panicked because he was going to a carriage house that he knew real well, and back off the street, and he went there, and it wasn't there. It wasn't there, and then he left there and went down the street, and the red light just stayed red. I mean, it never got to be green, you know. And he was really shook up because he really lost his bearings. So it could have that effect. Now, before I go to the dangerous drugs, it's probably just as well here. Now, the latest thing on marijuana, I should say that a lot of the argument on this is that a lot of people say we can't really prove anything on marijuana. That people have been using it for a long time, and it's... It's not as bad as alcohol. You get sort of a lift from it that sort of lightens the load at the end of the day or the end of the week. But there have been no real follow-up studies on it, and until very recently, they didn't have the active product synthesized or extracted. Well, only recently they have. And at the American Medical Association meetings, week before last, in San Francisco, they made a release, a joint release of the American Medical Association and the National Research Council, and some of the things they said about it are summarized in these words. The headline or the subheadline was sort of "Marijuana is indeed a dangerous drug, and experimental evidence is now beginning to prove it." Two major scientific organizations declared it yesterday. That's the two I named. They termed the growing use of marijuana a major public health problem and said that plants' active chemicals have produced psychosis in both animals and humans. In animal studies, the research report said marijuana has proved more powerful than many other psychological active drugs, including barbiturates, and is far stronger than alcohol. Well, it all depends on the dose you take, you see. And they have actually done a study. Dr. Harris Isbell, who's at Kentucky, I had 30 volunteers that he had taken the drug or the chemical derivative and studied their effect. The volunteers smoked it and impregnated their tobacco with it, and they also took the chemical orally. And they saw sort of the spectrum of effect, from sort of a mild lift to a psychotic reaction. In fact, they hallucinated with higher doses. Their perceptions were distorted, and one even became so rigidly withdrawn as seriously ill schizophrenics are. And the other thing they said about it, and this will we should get into probably the legal aspects of it. The only thing I know is sort of how they respond to it, and more about the chemical reactions to it or the physiological reactions. But the hazard of it, you know, the big argument is, well, you know, you don't get hooked on it, see? They say you don't get really hooked. Well, the hazard is that many chronic marijuana users become psychologically dependent on it and find they cannot give it up without psychiatric help. And this is one of the problems. Now, what they said about law in this was that what it did suggest, and these people suggested, is that the laws be changed so that the courts have discretionary power over casual users. Perhaps punishing them is nothing more serious than a minor traffic violation. And this is where the big argument is today. That you are essentially, well, they summarize it here, the lives of many young people are being needlessly damaged, the report said, by treating casual youngsters as criminals when they merely experiment with a drug. I think that's enough at this stage for marijuana. Now I'll just hit the dangerous drugs briefly. These are drugs that require a prescription. There are three classes of them. Of these, they're non-narcotic drugs, but they are habit-forming, or can be habit-forming, and they have a potential for abuse because of either their stimulant, depressing, or hallucinogenic effect. The first, the stimulants. The most widely used and abused stimulant are the amphetamines. You probably know them as pep pills. They're also called bennies or dexies within the community. They are used in fatigue, overweight, for people overweight, mental disorders. They're often prescribed for this. They do elevate your mood. They induce a state of well-being and elation. You do develop a tolerance. There is an increase, with increase in dose. And with higher doses, you can get delusions and hallucinations. The depressants. This is the second category. They're most widely used and abused. The most widely used and abused of the depressants are the barbiturates. They're also called goofballs, nimbies, or seki. Now, these are sort of from the proprietary name. Some of you know them as Nimbutol or secobarbital. There are about 25 barbiturates on the market. We use them a lot in anesthesia. One of the common anesthesias in animals. They're also used as hypnotics, as sedatives, to relieve tension, to relieve anxiety, and to create sleep. It's also the most common utilized chemical, I think, for suicide. There is a physical dependence on it. In fact, even our dog, as some of you know, in the laboratory in which I work, we use quite a few dogs. In fact, we have 12 ton of them. That's a total of about 1,200 beagles. And some of these dogs are brought in very frequently for anesthesia, for Nimbutol, for phenobarbital sodium anesthesia. And after quite a few of these, the dog almost sticks out his arm, you know. he's really hooked on it. That's how people get. Where was I before I got to the dog? And also under the depressants, we have to add something that's been a very marketable product in recent times, and that they are the tranquilizers and the sedatives. a tremendous market for this now. Milltown, Equinol, these are some of the early ones. Librium, we have a lot of Tranemol and veterinary medicine and all kinds of them. There's all kinds of them. And of course, this an excess of these, you can get drug intoxication, and there is eventually a physical dependence on these depressants. Now, the hallucinogens, I want to talk about the money investment too, but I think I'll go to the hallucinogens. Now, these are available. I mean, you can't go down and buy these, with one exception. Most of them, like LSD, I mean, it's a dangerous drug, and the only way you can get it, and it's even tough for some research workers to get it now, so my associates are working with it, they are available only by special permit from the Food and Drug Administration. The exception of these hallucinogens is peyote, which is from a cactus plant. Mescaline, which some of you know, is a derivative of peyote. And this is, interestingly enough, this is utilized and is authorized for utilization in connection with the religious ceremonies of the Native American church, about the Indians, you know. The Indians have been using peyote for a long, long time as part of their religious rites. And there was one fellow, and I forgot his name now, I left some of my notes, but this fellow went to bat for the Indians. He says, all you Christians, you use wine in your services, and these fellows have been using peyote. And I think it went clear to the Supreme Court. And they have allowed, I think it's used bi-weekly or something. And you, when you take this, you know, things sort of brighten up for you. I mean, you sort of see the deep blue, you know. And this is part of their rites and in their services. And so this is allowed. It's the only exception that I know of. Now let's talk about LSD for a moment. They were doing experiments when I was at the University of Washington. And of course, the way you do experiments, you get line up graduate students. And then you run them through this. And I was a graduate student at that time, but they didn't get me cornered. Because I have sort of a standing rule that I don't take anything that I figure that isn't going to do me any good. And I just do not experiment on some of these things. But some of my associates did, and the reactions were quite unusual. But you can use this drug, and it has been utilized in therapy and probably with some effect. But the main thing is that you have somebody that knows what they're doing so they can talk them through it, you see. And they regulate the dose, they have a pure product, and they can take them through it. The great hazard in this thing, you see, it takes so little to get an effect. If you can imagine, 1/280,000 of an ounce. Huh? I mean, that's very little, you see. It's in microgram quantities. And this gives you an effect. LSD stands for lysergic acid, diethylamide. But you can, it's all right if you say LSD. Most people don't know what you mean. But it removes you from reality. I mean, really does. And the hazard of it, of course, damage to the system. Now, I'll go back to Seattle to my friend Fred Harris. And when he first came to Seattle, his bass player was there. And he was really a promising bass player in his jazz band. But he went on LSD. And he's really gone down the tubes. And in fact, the other day, he got a call from him. He called up Fred and he says, "Hey, I want you to come down and see me." He says, "Boy, I got a problem." You know, he went down there and he says, he shut all the doors and he says, "Do you know if they're doing some secret work up at the University of Washington? Is the CIA in there?" And he says, "I know they're around here because they're using these ultrasonic devices and they're turning it in on our joint here." He has sort of a coffee house down there just across the University Bridge. And he said they're making every trip a bad one. And he described some of the symptoms. I mean, this guy's really gone. He's got two little children. Well, Fred is in a quandary. I mean, does he turn him in? And I says, "Boy, you better think about those kids, you know." I mean, he says, "Boy, it'll make them worse, you know. It'll react to that life is really persecuting him." This guy's gone down the tube. Now, here's how I regard LSD. I might as well tell you right now. It's sort of how I regard it is, unless it's under very close scrutiny and for very special cases. I regard it as a large computer, a very large computer that maybe filled this room. And if I went into that computer and say I kicked it and I went back and cut a few wires, increased the amperage on some circuits and maybe pulled out a few tubes, chances are I wouldn't help it. You know, I wouldn't help this thing. There might be some lights flashing and a few other things for a while, but I wouldn't really have a very beneficial effect on the computer. Well, that's how I regard LSD on this computer. Huh? Now, let me tell you a little bit about why there's illicit traffic in this. And I'll just take the thing on some of these amphetamine and phenobarb, if I can find it here. All right, back a few years ago, we produced over 9 billion doses of barbiturate in 1 year. There's some suspicion that probably at least half of this went into the black market here in the United States. In other words, not across the counter, you see. Now, what is the price of one of these, huh? Well, you can get them some places for 10 cents, but some of them go up to a buck. Well, let us say it's 50 cents a piece. Well, 50 cents a piece of half of 9 billion is roughly 4.5 billion. You take 50 cents for each one. You're talking about a pile of dough, huh? That's a lot of razzbucknicks. And half of the amphetamine was probably the other thing I want to tell you now, where does our hard stuff, where does our heroin come from? This is interesting, you know. Turkey grows it, and a lot of the farmers, I mean, it's legalized, the growth of the poppy there, but a lot of the farmers black market. And they get about $350 for 10 kilograms, that's about 20 pounds. All right? It goes to France, most of it goes to France, to the illicit market there, to the chemical plants there, and they reduce it down to heroin, you see? So you get about 1 kilogram, about 2 pounds out of this, you see? 2 pounds out of that $350. That's really the hot stuff. I mean, it'll really give you a nudge. And so then it comes into this country, either through Canada or through Mexico. Now what does this 1 kilogram end up with here? About $225,000. And I don't know how many thousand kilograms come in, but there's quite a few, and you can start figuring out the money involved here. This is big business. I mean, this is big money. So that might tell you why, and of course they're picking it up all the time, but with this quantity coming in, you know, it's just a few kilograms get in here and there. So it becomes a real problem. Now on treatment, and then I got to get going, so you folks can tell something about this. And I'll go through these very rapidly. There are two large public health service hospitals. One is at Lexington and the other one at Fort Worth. Together they take about a couple of thousand patients at one time. I guess the average stay is probably 5 months. And these are mainly for federal prisoners, but they'll take some voluntary patients. That's number one. Number two is the California Rehabilitation Center, established in 1961. It has in and outpatient service. The average stay is 15 months with a 6 months follow-up. They have sort of a halfway house for these fellows called Parkway Center, where they have them as outpatients, and after they go through 3 drug-free years, they then release them. But they do pull surprise checks on them to see if they're taking it, you see. They come in for checks. And they also run a test on it. The New York State program, I think you have 6 state hospitals there, and you might want to comment on this. And they have in and out patient service. The State Narcotic Control Commission is just building a treatment prevention center. Maybe it's already built. I know they, back in 66, they started out with $75 million to build a rehabilitation center. There's also a group called Synanon, which has headquarters in Santa Monica. And this is a private anti-addiction society. It was founded in 1958. So most of these you see are very recent. It's made up and managed by ex-addicts, volunteer medical staff, And they attack therapy, they use group therapy, and they can kick them out if they don't, hang tough. They have a sort of another program called Daycop Lodge. This is a voluntary program in Brooklyn, which some of you may want to comment on. There's another one, something like this, which I'll mention last because it's one of the most recent and rather an interesting one. And I know that Terrell probably comment on methadone maintenance, or he might want to pronounce it differently. This is for heroin addiction. It was developed at Rockefeller University Hospital. They sort of select their cases. It's a synthetic opiate that is also addictive, but it blocks the euphoric effects of heroin, and it does not produce euphoria, sedation, or distortion of behavior. At least that's what the label on the bottle says. But they remain alert and functionally normal. But Harold's going to have something to say about it. Now, there's a good deal of activity right now in the drug industry. And a friend of mine has been interested in this, but I didn't get him on the phone just before I left. And he told me a little bit about it. But there are some long-acting opiate antagonists. In other words, if they can give a chemical, it's really an antagonist of the opiate. It may block the effect, say, of heroin. And there's a good deal of effort in this regard, but there's nothing really much to say. They also use the parole system, which is sort of common, it's part of what some of the systems I've already mentioned, where you're really checked as an outpatient, and they come in and you keep very close tab on them to kind of keep them off the needle. The DARE program, D-A-R-E, which stands for Drug Addiction Rehabilitation Enterprise. I heard it over the radio when I was back east one time. It started in Newark, New Jersey in about January last year. And they're going sort of gung-ho now. They're getting a lot of publicity. It's made up of addicts. And they have, unlike this other one I mentioned, where they can sort of come and go. They're in a way on their honor. It's sort of modified it's patterned after Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's turning out, I guess, to be very effective, at least so far. It's a little early to tell, but they claim at least by now to have 4 definite cures, is what he says. And it has had some unusual early response. And another thing they do, which I think is a very necessary one, because it not only attacks this, but they are making people aware of a prevention program. And they say that the potential drug addict most definitely begins experimenting in his early adolescence. What we have to offer your school is a group of young people who are capable of reaching those students to whom this would apply, because they've lived it and experienced the false glamour of drug addiction. So they're also attacking it from that standpoint. And so it's sort of an exciting thing. And with that, I will turn it over first to Harold.
Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about the experience I had with heroin addicts in New York City.
We should say that about half of them are in New York City. Half of the addicts in this country are probably in New York City. Aren't they in New York?
I worked with them as a caseworker for the New York City Department of Welfare Bureau of Public Assistance. I had rather a strange relationship with them.
You all hear him?
No.
You guys talk a little louder.
I was a caseworker with the New York City Department of Welfare Bureau of Public Assistance, which meant that my relationship to them was rather strange, and because of this, I probably don't have the best insight. My responsibility was to maintain them financially, to try and refer them to some kind of aftercare treatment. Anytime most of the addicts didn't want to get involved in anything like this, and so almost anything, maybe just associating them with a group that wasn't specifically concerned with the problems of addicts but was concerned with the problems of poor people, would be good enough. But there was a great deal of difficulty getting interested in anything. Most of the addicts I had lied to me constantly. They didn't trust me. I represented the establishment, I was going to lock them up, I was going to punish them in some way, and so it's very difficult for me to really help them in any way. I'm going to tell about one fellow who I believe is fairly typical of this type of addict, who I did get to know very well, and who I don't know what he's doing today. As far as I know, he's probably shooting himself or dead. Joseph Desdune is 26 years old when I met him. He was probably one of the oldest addicts that I had. He mentioned the age was 21 to 30. I think it's probably more like 18 to 26. Most of the addicts told me that they started experimenting with drugs at 11, 12 years of age. Typically, they started with marijuana. Desdune came to the Department of Welfare after having been released from a methadone detoxification program in one of the city hospitals in New York. All the city hospitals in New York have this kind of approach. Any addict, theoretically, is supposed to be able to walk off the street, say, I'm an addict, and take them in and run through this methadone detoxification. This means they keep them in the hospital for about a week or so. They give them methadone, and they keep them for a week without anything, and then they send them out. They refer them to the Department of Welfare. They're supposed to find an apartment, buy them clothes, help them look for a job, and things are supposed to be fine. So he came to me this way, and the only thing I knew about him was that he had a history of drug addiction. I didn't know how much. He apparently hadn't told anybody how much. The hospital didn't know how much. They considered him cured, so he didn't have to be registered with anybody. He wasn't an addict anymore as far as all the records were concerned. So we located an apartment for him. Got him some clothes, gave him the money for clothes, and computed a budget for him. Supposedly he was going to take care of his needs. I visited him the first time to talk about possibilities of job training and stuff like this. And he wasn't in the apartment, and the landlord told me that he never checked in. He was never there. So I suspended the case. He came in a few days later, told me that he had been robbed in the park, and that he needed an apartment. He was in as bad shape as he was before. So I asked him, you know, who robbed me? Well, some addicts robbed me. Are you an addict? No. We picked him up with another apartment. He went there, and I visited him quite a few times, and he told me a little bit about his history of drug addiction. He started taking drugs rather late. Most of the addicts start fooling around when they're 11, 12. He didn't start fooling around until he was in high school, because he had, I think, more of a success pattern than most of these guys. He's exceptionally bright. He completed 3 years of high school. He took a completely academic program. He took 3 years of Latin and 2 years of French. He still knew some of his Latin. As a hobby, he was interested in Greek mythology. He knew quite a bit about Socrates. And he was good in math. He could still remember something of high school intermediate algebra and stuff like this. He had planned to go to college. He was also a very, very physically small fellow. He looked like a human. And he lived in a very poor, depressed neighborhood, a very tough neighborhood. And apparently, as he described it, he just couldn't compete on the street scene. He could compete very well in the classroom, but this gave him no prestige at all. And in fact, he was always trying to defend to his peers, you know, his interests and his propensity to study and so on. And as I said, because he was so physically weak, he needed to do something to get some kind of street prestige. And so he was encouraged sometime in high school to start fooling around with pot, which he did, and which everybody did, and which probably wouldn't have been a bad experience for him at all. But at one party, when he was a junior in high school, there was a collection taken up, and he thought that some people were going to go out and buy a beer. and they came back with heroin, and everyone who had contributed to them was expected to try it. And he said he didn't want to try it, but, he was talked into it. He tried it and got violently sick. He was throwing up and nauseated for all night long, probably like this dog or cat you're talking about. And it was just the most awful thing that he ever experienced. Nobody, at the party knew what to do to take care of him. They were all panicked. They had seen this before, I guess, but they really didn't know what to do. But anyway, what happened was, after he came out of this, he was somewhat of a hero to having gone through this, and the idea was to try it again to prove that he was going to. So he was just trying, once in a while, at parties, and it was a party thing for a while, but every time he tried it, it brought him a great deal of prestige. He began to get prestige in the street scene, began to lose interest in school. The real need was to have something like this. He dropped out of school as a junior in high school. Hung around the blocks with the addicts and the pushers. Many of them had the practice of giving the young guys free stuff, and then they later turned out to be the pushers and took advantage of them this way. For about 2 years or so, he was just this party type experimenter. And he doesn't know when it happened, but he just noticed that he gradually began to need more of this stuff. He didn't like the idea. He tried to stop, but he was always being pressured by friends and peers on junkies on the street and stuff like this. Don't try it, don't chicken out. This is part of being a man. And he built himself up to a habit of about $60 a day. That means
$60.
Yeah, $60 a day.
No, the average is really closer to 15, isn't it?
No, I don't think so.
You think it's higher than that?
Oh, much higher than that.
Do you? Well, maybe I'm citing old figures in here.
$60 a day, and this was quite typical of most of the Series X. $40 to $60 seemed to be the range. Now, I don't know exactly how much they got to this. They talk the language I don't understand about bags and this and that. How much is in a bag, I don't know. But evidently, he was shooting himself maybe three or four times a day, and that was all. But he couldn't miss it. And consequently, sometimes the price was higher than it was other times.
No, and it depends. You see, the trouble with that stuff, you see, it might vary in percent. The percent active stuff in it may vary from 1 to 30%. A lot of them dilute it out. But it used to be, in 65, it was $5 a bag.
No, I'm sure it was more than $5. So consequently, this led into all kinds of other things. Mostly getting the money by getting the girl to hustle for him. And this is the way most addicts support themselves. The girls hustle, and the guys get a girl that hustles for them. They live with the girl, they don't have sexual relations with the girl, but she hustles for them, they split the money. Usually they're both addicts. And she's got to do a lot of hustling, to make this kind of money. Now this is like $100 a day for the two of them. In a slum neighborhood, she isn't making very much money. Most of these girls hustled right in the neighborhoods where they lived. They didn't, they weren't tall girls, they weren't fancy prostitutes or anything like that. They were just very cheap sluts. So they did a lot of hustling, a lot of robbing, and a lot of, petty theft from, their fellow addicts and other guys. So in the high addiction neighborhoods, the single fellows that lived in the high addiction neighborhoods were always having their money robbed the day after they got the public assistance check. Mm-hmm. There's a check of, $120 maybe. And, they're paid by check. They can't cash it in the bank. They can't have bank accounts. They got to cash it and get the cash and then trot over and pay the landlord, and then trot downtown and pay the electric bill. They got to have all this cash. There's really no way they can defend themselves. It's obvious that if you live in this neighborhood, it's likely that you're on public assistance, and you know what day the check comes out, and so you just pick anybody and look small, beat them up and take his money. And so this was another source of income. Desdun had never been to jail, which was one reason why I thought there was a better chance for him maybe to get off this thing than some of the other people. Most of the addicts had been in jail 2 or 3 times. They'd been through these methadone treatments 2 or 3 times also. The family go to jail, the judge may send them through the methadone treatment first, then to jail. Apparently, you know, the methadone treatment doesn't work, obviously, because people just keep going through it. And they come back out on the streets and they're addicts again. The addicts, when I was with them, when they were shot up, seemed very, very friendly and warm and gregarious and loving. And boy, they'd come up to me and they'd throw their arm around me and say, "Mr. Griffin, you're the best," and then some colloquial adjectives. Fellow that I've ever met, and boy, I'm going to go out and get a job tomorrow. And usually they felt they just needed a little clothes, money, and then they would be able to get to their door. They'd take anything. They were willing to do anything to break the habit, and so on and so forth. As I know that this is no good for me. When they weren't on it, they still talked in terms of breaking the habit. Nobody that I worked with that was an addict wanted to be an addict. Nobody that was an addict that I worked with liked being an addict or anything about it. Nobody that I worked with that was an addict liked themselves at all. They probably didn't like themselves before they were addicts, but at least as addicts, they despised themselves. They couldn't stand themselves. They were very threatened by everybody. And they were threatened by the welfare department, most of all, probably the establishment system. But because of this, they were really, you know, paralyzed, unable to do anything. And consequently, trying to encourage an addict into some of these aftercare programs was an exceptionally difficult job. They would go, maybe, register, and then drop out right away. It's a peculiar addict, I think, that goes through one of these programs. Anyway, Desdun convinced me that he was breaking the habit. And he was breaking it by an interesting method. Another addict using drinking gin. Apparently, addicts don't like to drink and shoot themselves at the same time. And just by bombing themselves out on gin, they're able to, you know, go through these withdrawal symptoms very easily. And you know, then they're, you know, in the position of either trying to become, like, get over being alcoholic or they're becoming alcoholic or something like this. But this is a typical pattern. But anyway, he seemed extremely sincere. So we talked about his school record and the possibility of further training. Very enthusiastic. We talked about Greek mythology. He was obviously knew all of this stuff. He said he hadn't read it in 4 or 5 years, but he just remembered. It was obvious to me that he was a very talented, intelligent person. He didn't believe this. But we talked about the possibility of his finishing high school and then getting some kind of post-high school training one afternoon. We talked all afternoon about this, and this was at the office. I was going to go out and visit him the next day, and I went out to visit him, and he was gone. And that was the last I heard. And I wondered what happened to him, except that I suppose that the idea, you know, of doing something for himself scared him so that he just disappeared. He couldn't face it. And you know, I'm just sort of throwing this out as a hypothesis that perhaps this is one of the you know, real traits in the addictive personality that we should understand more about if we're going to understand anything about drug addiction. Okay, well, We'll stop there.
My information, of course, would be geared to the high school student. I did some drug research for my thesis in terms of youth ministry and approach to high school kids. So I'm more concerned about where our high school kids are concerned drugs, not necessarily the hardcore that he was concerned with. I was fortunate enough to find a report or get in touch with someone who knew a Brooklyn young person who was on drugs and knew the drug scene pretty well, a high school boy, and who was willing to sit down and talk and kind of give us the information about where everybody in his neighborhood was. Now, this was not a ghetto kid. This was not a really poor kid. He was a middle class, well, maybe lower middle class kid. They lived in Brooklyn, and this is how his neighborhood worked. When you are between about, as he describes it, 9 to 11, glue sniffing begins. He tells about his first experience with glue sniffing about 9, and how all the boys said, man, you'll have a great trip. And then he tells about how it burned his nose, the inside of his nose and everything, but man, everybody said it was neat, so you have to do it. And how at 10 and 11 then, or 11 and 12, the big thing is to go around and get 8 or 9 year old boys to try it. And you get it in a bag and you make them sniff it, and if they run away, you call them chicken, that type of thing. This is where it starts in the community. And so he was questioned about, well, you know, where do you buy the glue? And he says, oh man, you go and buy a model airplane and buy 6 bottles of glue. You know, the guy never bothered to ask you if you need all those bottles of glue to put the airplane together.
And yeah, or a paint thinner. Now he used paint thinner, and now they use UV thinner. Gasoline.
Anyway, he told us, quite frankly, places where they got it and how it wasn't just rubbed off. And then he said, from there, many of his friends went on to cough syrup. Now, cough syrup was pretty easy to get. In fact, there are many places where you can walk out with 6 bottles and no one bothers to ask any questions. And these are the ones, of course, that give them kind of high, and they just kind of go on and kind of happy for some time, I guess. Then they have, after the cough syrup, then many of them went into marijuana. Now, when I was in Seattle for the summer before last, I thought, man, if I was going to work in Seattle, I'd better find out what the drug scene was there. It became quite obvious that the San Francisco hippies had decided that Seattle might be able to have room for them, so they'd come to join us. And talking to someone who was really on the scene there, discovered that half of us, at least one high school, half of both junior and senior classes he had statistics on, had tried marijuana. Some of the hippies had brought the drugs with them or had access to get them and were supporting themselves, many of the hippies that he knew, on drugs or by selling drugs to kids. So they turned on our high school set in Seattle, and they're still turned on. We were doing some street work on the beach the other day and accidentally ran 2 girls behind a bush, 3 girls behind a bush that we had a weed, and they were passing around and having a pretty jolly good time with it. Now, if you were doing street work and you bumped into a car like that, what would you do?
They'll give you an answer in about 5 minutes.
Good. So in other words, about 50% of our high school kids, I would say, in middle income situations, are using marijuana. And it's just like you said, it's just like, you know, you used to go out and you try to, you know, you get an older guy to buy the beer for you. Well, they just naturally bring pot now, that kind of thing. And sometime one of your kids is probably going to go to a party where it just happens to be. And I remember the first party I went when they took the liquor out of the liquor cabinet, and I remember how I felt, you know, was I going to drink it to be part of the gang or what I was going to do. And stop to think about what you think kids are going to have to face, perhaps quite soon. And then he went on to tell about how they went into barbiturates and this type of thing. And this was usually, well, 13, he said, they started on marijuana in Brooklyn. And these others then followed all the way through high school. And then the hardcore heroin usually came, usually about 18, he said. And then from 18 to 26, he knew lots of them that were on heroin and how the girls became prostitutes and the guys became the pimps that went out to get the jobs of the girls. And they had also turned to crime, as we mentioned. Then LSD was in a kind of a different bag altogether. He thought people who tried LSD were kind of strange. Some experiences that I...
But they weren't strange, they got to be strange.
Some experiences I have with LSD, not myself, but some friends, as a matter of fact, a relative, so it's really not funny to me, having tried it months ago, just recently, he freaked out one night with absolutely no drug stimulation at all. But they say that often the LSD does reoccur a month later. Now, the courts or no one else has been able to find out if this was lied, even his doctors. The doctor very cleverly said, this young man is in nervous, having a nervous breakdown. And thank God got him out of the courts without a drug, you know, case against him, because actually the boy had not taken drugs that night. But what he did was he just kind of freaked out, and he and his girlfriend were coming home from a drive-in movie, and they led the cops on a 70-mile-an-hour chase through our small town, which is quite a feat. Wrecked the almost five police cars in town, just damaged them a little bit. And so the police in town weren't too happy about it, and this is the kind of thing that can happen later on. And he said to me, but, you know, I just took a little bit of it many months ago, and it didn't do anything to me. In fact, I don't even care for it, he said. And yet, this is the kind of reaction. I had another experience the other day with LSD. Now, I know that in my work, lots of these kind of opportunities are going to come up. And as I may have mentioned some of you earlier today, we took this car out to paint it, you know, to think that, you know, we helped attract the kids. Well, as I told you, attracted about, you know, young adult type men who were drunk. And it did attract one kid who thought he was really cool. He came over and he says, hey man, you've been tripping out. Well, he happened to be painting the fender near me, so I assumed that he was directing the comment to me. And I don't quite, I mean, I know how I feel about this, but how do you talk to a guy who's using the language when you don't use the language? And so I thought I'd be sort of flip about it. So he says, hey man, you're tripping out. And I says, no, I'm thinking about my chromosomes, you know. And, that's true. And so he said, oh man, you plan to reproduce. And I said, yeah, hopefully someday, you know. And so my staff and I talked about this afterwards, is whether I've done the right thing. We're not sure yet. I'd just like to say two more things. One is that if you notice what happened in the case of this young man, I think this is a tremendous interesting time what Jerry said this morning about how this kid needed peer acceptance so badly that he went to the extremes that he went to. Hopefully in the ministry that we're trying to do, maybe a little bit older adult than, I mean a little bit older youth, maybe can fill this gap where the peer group just isn't coming through like it didn't come through for this kid. If he had maybe just one friend who maybe stood by him and said, man, I think your grades are great, you know, maybe he might have been able to make it through this time. But as you see in this case, he didn't. I'd just like to tie in one more thing, and I think you might be interested in this too, compared to what we did last night. The Daytop Village group does what they call an all-night marathon. Maybe it lasts for a weekend, depending on the guy they have to get in on that's the addict. And what they do, from my understanding of this now, is that they tear the guy down. You know how you shoot a guy down? Well, how would you like to have, like, you know, 12 former addicts shooting you down? You know, you're kind of like, you're placed in the middle of the spotlight, and they just spend the whole time trying to get you to admit, you know, that yes, drugs are wrong, and yes, I want to be off drugs. It's kind of, well, you know, like Alcoholics Anonymous, in a sense. And then, after they've gotten to the point where he admits that he's a slob, you know, then they love him, and they accept him in the group, and he becomes part of the community. And it's this love then that sustains him through the drying out and the period that he lives in this Daytop Village. And from what I've heard, the results can just be terrific. And as a matter of fact, they've made a play up about it. And the addicts themselves, former addicts living here by this method, there are two casts right now in New York doing it. And it's a marvelous thing. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to see it before I left last month, but they just, you know, they show what it's like, and they use all the language they use, and, you know, they show you exactly what it's like to be in a marathon experience. Now, I myself had a marathon experience for an urban class I had with some Catholic seminarians, which was kind of interesting. They'd never been set in the same room with, well, women for 16 hours before. They soon learned what that was like. But I would say the only thing wrong with that is the community is great, and they certainly have the community. But what happens when you go on the street? I wonder if Daytop Village can sustain that feeling, you know, of community that they were able to provide for these addicts and follow that through.